Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.
This is Dundee Law, where the great William Topaz McGonagall actually stood, walked, composed, and mused and spent some of his time. It isn't quite Magdalen Green, but it'll do.
And what you just heard there, my friends, is comedian Billy Connolly. And where's he standing, Scott?
Billy Connolly is doing a McGonagall poem in the from the top of Dundee Law, which stands in the middle of Dundee, Scotland, home to William McGonagall.
That's right. And Billy Connolly, of course, the famous international Scottish comedian, reciting also another famous Scottish known entity, William Topaz McGonagall, who has notoriety of being the worst poet in Scottish history.
'Twas about 7 o'clock at night, and the wind it blew with all its might. And the rain came pouring down, and the dark clouds seemed to frown, and the demon of the air did say, I'll blow down that bridge of Tay.
And who also went on to really inspire a lot of British comedians. And, of course, welcome everyone to another episode of
Comedy History 101.
Where we school you in comedy. I, of course, am Harmon Leon, and with me, all the way from Berlin now, is Scott Kalanico. Ich bin ein Scott Kalanico.
Hello, Harmon, wie geht's?
That's probably some German greeting that I don't understand, correct?
Okay, I just said, how's it going?
Oh, yeah, fine. Ich bin good. I am good. Yeah.
Good now. All right.
So what Billy Connolly was reciting was a poem called The Tay Bridge Disaster. Here's a few lines, once again, from the Tay Bridge Disaster. Beautiful railway bridge of the Silvery Tay. Alas, I am very sorry to say that 99 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time. So according to the so that poem documents what's the history? It documents a great railway disaster that took place in Dundee, Scotland.
Yeah, that was the largest railway disaster in the UK at the time. It was right before New Year's in 1879. Basically, the Tay Bridge was known as the eighth wonder of the world. It was the longest railway bridge in the world. I think it was a little bit over a mile or just under a mile.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty impressive, actually. A little scary if you look at it now and go, you guys were actually driving trains over that thing? But it was General Grant saw it. It was held to be one of the engineering wonders of the world. And during a storm at the very end of 1879, train was driving over the bridge. Gust of wind came along and knocked the train and the whole bridge over.
Yeah, and with that, poet William Topaz McGonagall decided to write the poem, The Tay Bridge Disaster, which not only is William Topaz McGonagall considered the worst poet in Scottish history, but this poem, The Tay Bridge Disaster, is considered his worst poem.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
He rhymes
buttresses with confesses. That's it, to give you just a brief overview.
See, there's two camps I have about McGonagall, and what they said about McGonagall back in the day, just to bring our listeners up to speed, was he was so giftedly bad. He unwittingly backed into genius. And he went on to influence, like, you know, the likes of Peter Sellers, the Muppets, Monty Python, and, of course, the Harry Potter series where they have Professor
Spike Milligan.
Yeah, Spike Milligan, who Peter Sellers was part of the Goon Squad with Spike Milligan. And so he has had this lasting effect on British comedy in general. But what do you think made him so giftedly bad he unwittingly backed into genius?
I would say quite definitely that the poetry is awful.
He's a lazy poet. He doesn't try and find the right word. He just tries to find something that'll actually suit a rhyme, if you like.
In terms of the standard canon of English literature, he was not a good poet. He was a disastrous poet.
And how many poets get a rhyme with the word buttresses?
he rhymed buttresses with, what did buttresses rhyme with?
Confesses.
But to me, that is like almost like what you get from like Johnny Lydon from the Sex Pistols, of how he would carve, you know, the great, you know, rhymes that came out of like, you know, Sex Pistols songs.
I am an Antichrist. I am an Anarchist.
And yeah, standard poetry senses, that does sound bad, but, you know, or is that genius? So maybe that's part of the thesis of this podcast, is that was he giftedly bad, or was he an avant-garde Andy Kaufman-esque genius ahead of his time?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes into there, and I would say it's not, yeah, if you just read the poetry, it's like, okay, what's going on here? Maybe it's not that bad, but I think it's more of like how he was so, you know, insistent on selling himself as a poet. I think that makes it kind of the comic angle to the whole thing.
Yeah, I think a large part about that, and we both read his autobiography, is probably in the presentation as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would say that.
Because let's describe like a standard McGonagall performance, if you will. So he would perform a lot, first of all, in pubs. So you got a lot of drunken people. And what would it be like if you were in the pub and you saw McGonagall on stage reciting, say, his poem, The Famous Tay Whale, or his poem, The Beautiful City of Perth, or his poem, Beautiful North Berwick? he had a lot of poems about praises of cities.
He's very geographically precise. I think it was kind of the same way as he would do his performances on stage. He would make a show out of it, and he would not just do a poem. He would go up there and he would perform for like an hour, you know, maybe a little under an hour, and he would do poems, he would do bits of Shakespeare, he would do bits of other plays, he would do some other people's poems, you know, he would do soliloquies from other Shakespeare plays. So he would do like a whole grab bag of stuff. It wasn't just him up there saying poems. And like then he would reenact, like if he was doing a play, he'd reenact the parts in the play and things like that. So he would put on a big show. One of his famous poems was the Battle of Bannockburn, the famous battle in Scotland. And he made a big point of, he would come on stage wearing a kilt and he'd get the audience going along. He'd be banging along with his cudgel on the stage, you know, and making a big noise. It was like something that people like.
Yeah, watched. So he was like a song and dance man in a way.
Right, kind of, you know, like a vaudevillian.
Yeah, well, music hall. I would go back to the British music hall. But so his poems and his performances, it usually, more typically than not, ended with the audience pelting him with rotten eggs and peas and herring.
Well, I must say that the first man who threw peas at me was a publican. But my dear friends, I wish it to be understood that the publican who threw the peas at me was not the landlord of the public house. He was one of the party who came to hear me give my entertainment.
They would pelt him with food, time after time again.
Yeah, that's actually how his autobiography opens up, is something along the lines of, I remember the first time I was pelted with peas.
So tell me this, so what were peas doing in pubs of the day?
Oh, no, actually, no, because I asked, I was very interested, I was interested about this, and I asked a Victorian scholar about it, and he was saying that was kind of like the snack of the day, that you would have, like, instead of peanuts or stuff, they would put peas in a pod, like, out on the bar and stuff, and that would be your...
Oh, like Anunami.
Yeah, like
Anunami. Oh, they're kind of you'd be playing at the hipster pubs of the day.
Yeah, he'd be playing with his twirly mustache.
So in modern era, McGonagall would be performing at the Cereal Cafe in Shoreditch in London.
Yeah,
he being pelted with Captain, like $10 milk. Bowls of Captain Crunch.
Wearing ironic trucker caps and his twisted curly mustache.
What would his modern poems be about?
No, he would be sitting at a bench with his typewriter, and you go up and give him a pound.
Oh, that's funny, because we have guys in Brooklyn.
I saw a guy here in the park. He'd write you a poem.
Yeah, we got a bunch of those guys. There's a guy on a typewriter.
On a typewriter
in the
park.
Yeah, it's always on a typewriter. And surprisingly, the poem's not so good.
No, we should pelt him with
Yeah, these. So the McGonagall of the day would be performing at the Serial Cafe, and he'd be writing poems about called The Beautiful City of Shoreditch.
the beautiful town. No, I think Hoxton might be the more thing.
Yeah.
More thing now. Hoxton.
So anyways, getting back to the McGonagall of the McGonagall, the original McGonagall, not the fictional hipster McGonagall that we've just presented, throughout his career he wrote over 200 poems, which were eventually put into a collection of poetry. And I love this, because McGonagall self-titled his collection of poetry, wait for it, Poetic Gems.
It was biting cold, and the falling snow which filled a poor little match girl's heart with woe, who was bareheaded and barefooted as she went along the street crying, "Who'll buy my matches? For I want pennies to buy some meat."
And then the best part is there's
more poetic gems.
So then there's like a sequel. Yeah, it's called More Poetic Gems. And then I think I'm pretty sure he came up with that title. But then after he died, then people would keep putting out his collections of poems, and so publishers kind of made a joke of it. Then they would call the next one's called Still Yet More Poetic Gems.
Yeah. I mean, that's hilarious. We could dive into this later on. But I speculate, was he possibly just the Andy Kaufman of his time, doing like Foreign Man or one of the other great bits that Andy Kaufman, who of course we've talked about on numerous podcasts here, including the history of the improv, was he like the in on the joke? Like that was part of it, you know, he wanted to go up there and get booed and then suddenly turn into Elvis Presley like Andy Kaufman? Or another speculation that was written about was he was sort of on the autism spectrum of things, where he actually did think he was the greatest poet in the world.
Yeah, I tend to think the latter, that he believed in himself,
which is endearing about McGonagall, and that's why, you know, he's persevered, and that's why, you know, he inspired, like, you know, Monty Python and Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers.
We'll get into the crazy aspects of the story, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff where it was just like somebody who was just doing this for a laugh. He does a lot of things that he's kind of like really, if it's a joke, he's like the best prankster in the world, you know?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, maybe he was the Andy Kaufman of the day, where he liked to stir things up, but, you know, that's just a theory. But a lot of things do point the other direction.
Yes, exactly.
So let's take it even further back. So McGonagall was born to Irish parents, but as records suggest that he was actually born in Ireland because native-born Scotsmen would be treated different under the Poor Law of 1845 rather than if you were born in Ireland. So you would get, I guess, what, certain type of financial breaks by being born in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you get entitled to alms or whatever. And I think you might have said at the beginning, you said he might have been claimed to have been born in Edinburgh.
He claimed, but he might have actually been born in Ireland.
Yeah, because he was he lived the part of Dundee where he lived and kind of grew up was known as like that's where it was, the Irish enclave of where, you know, people from Ireland had moved to.
Yeah, so his family moved. Do they move directly to Dundee or from Ireland? Do you know anything about that?
There's
history?
Something.
Or
yeah,
where was the first
actually,
place he lived
there's
in?
There's something where they might have lived in Orkney, which is way up north in Scotland for a while, and might have been something about Glasgow, but I'm 99% sure there was something about Orkney where they don't have any proof of it. Well, the interesting proof that they do have is from the census records, which are actually kind of funny as well, is because you can see, you know, the census every 10 years or whatever, and they would go around and they would go back to the McGonagall household and you know, you'd have to go, okay, who are you? You know, who are you married to? How many kids do you have? And what do you do for a living? And the census is really funny because in the census at one point, you know, it says, oh, he's a mill worker. And 10 years later it comes back and they say, it says, you know, occupation, and it says poet, and it's in quotation marks in the census.
So the census taker was doing.
Yeah, he was the census taker. It was actually, he added his own little quotes in there, poet.
So the census taker was the hipster of the day, putting ironic detachment upon McGonagall's prescribed profession.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, everyone. Before we get back to the podcast, just wanted to give a shout out to our newest sponsor, WordsOverChair.com. Words Over Chair is a full-service creative agency with offices in Brooklyn and Edinburgh that specializes in amazing storytelling, motion graphics, archival footage, all with a flair for humor. And the best part about WordsOverChair.com, you already like us. That's because Words Over Chair is run by yours truly, Harmon, along with my co-host, Scott Colonico. You might have seen our work on websites like Vice, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, Timeline, and many others. Want to make something boring? Fine, do it yourself. Want to make something cool? Get in touch with us. WordsOverChair.com.
So while in Dundee, McGonagall, he worked as a hand loom weaver in town. This was during the Industrial Revolution, where slowly weaving was become obsolete. But McGonagall, apparently, he was still making money as a weaver, as a skilled weaver at the time.
Yeah, he had actually one of the I guess you would call it the high-tech version. You know, this is, of course, the same industry where you had little nine-year-olds running around putting bobbins on machines at this time. But he actually worked in one of the kind of the more, handling weaver. You had to actually kind of operate the machines. But,
right.
his position was slowly being phased out as the Industrial Revolution, ground along. And what's interesting, too, is that Dundee was kind of the heart of the Industrial Revolution as far as Scotland's concerned. It was kind of like...
So when Dundee was sort of like the what Manchester would be to England, sort of the heart of the industrial boom.
Yeah, I mean, that was it, because Dundee had everything. Because it was this weird combination of... They had a source of running water, plenty of water for the steams to run the steam and the machines. And then also, because Dundee was a whaling town, so they had access to a lot of lubrication. So they could lubricate the machines and keep them running with steam power.
There you go. And whilst working as a weaver in Dundee, that's where McGonagall first got the showbiz bug. Before he showed an interest in poetry, he displayed a keen aptitude for acting. And Scott, can you know a little bit more about his acting career? I think it was like at the Mr. Gill's Theater, he performed the title role of Macbeth, and he filled the auditorium with friends and fellow weaver co-workers who were anxious to see McGonagall in the starring role because they were amused at the thought of this complete disaster.
Yeah, actually, it was the Theatre Royale in Dundee, which is still there. You can still see the busts that were outside where he performed. And basically what it was...
Really? So the theatre is still a
one of the theatres. Not the first theatre where he performed, but like where the one where he would actually kind of go and perform. And actually, it's referenced in the...
And also, Scott, tell the listeners why you have such a keen knowledge of Dundee.
Oh, well, because I used to live there, so I am on the ground.
Boom, boom, boom! There you go.
I do.
Yeah. So we're not just like secondhand.
No, we're here. We made a road a comedy 101, a comedy history 101 road trip up there.
Yeah. So I mean, Dundee, you are well familiar with. So you've actually seen the theater.
I've seen the theater where he performed. Yeah. And so what's interesting is that he would. McGonagall kind of got a start. He would perform like on the floor, like of the factory. Apparently, he would just be in a factory and he would start doing Shakespeare plays. All of his coworkers loved watching it, and the theater they convinced him that he should book a theater, and the theater owner would only book it like if they paid up front. So all his coworkers.
This sounds like you did like New York theater with a lot of like these bringer shows.
Yeah. So
he's the bringer show of the day.
All his coworkers pitched in because they wanted to see him perform so bad. So that led to his first performance in the theater, which was a rousing success.
Yeah. And if I could jump in here with the extreme funny bit of how Macbeth, starring William Tubbs McGonagall, ended, of course, the play, the Shakespeare play, Macbeth, ends with the death of Macbeth in a sword duel with Macduff. But McGonagall on stage felt the actor playing Macduff was trying to upstage him. So at the point in the Shakespeare play where Macbeth is supposed to die, McGonagall refused to die, and he kept sword fighting and ad-libbing to the point where the actor playing Macduff tried to trip McGonagall. So yeah. he died. So he just refused to die. And then the audience went like complete apeshit over the fact that McGonagall as Macbeth would refuse to die, and just even encouraged it even more. I could just, like, you know, I could imagine.
Yeah, just scenario. All it's all your friends in the theater packed, and they don't want you to die. The interesting, funny thing about this is that, you know, it sounds like one of those, you know, those made up stories. What's the word for that? I can't pronounce it right. But it sounds like one of those made up stories afterwards. But there are actual newspaper reports from the Dundee papers saying, you know, witnesses saying, yeah, this is what happened.
Yeah, and again, I can relate to this so much because, like, in 10th grade, I was in the school play, but I was also on the school soccer team. And I was in the school play, and I had maybe two lines. And I just remember one performance, all my, like, soccer team friends came. And they sat in the front row, and I just, like, way over the top sold the lines, and they were going nuts. And then whenever I make a movement, they would start chanting my name, and all the like, you know, upperclassmen theater people were just getting so fucking annoyed. But it just, you know, encouraged me on to just to go even more over the top with any kind of subtle sort of movement. So I was just basically playing for my friends in the audience.
You're like the McGonagall of Minneapolis. The McGonagall of
so you can
Minnesota.
You can see how he got caught up in that. And yeah. It's just like, you know, it's a great McGonagall moment.
Yeah.
But so that was his first taste of showbiz. But in 1877, at the age of 52, that's when it all changed for McGonagall. That's when he got bitten by the poetry bug. He was still working at the, what'd you call it, a weaving factory?
Right.
And so the quote from McGonagall is, "The most startling incident in my life was the time I discovered myself to be a poet, which was in the year 1877.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. People, I talked to a couple of scholars about this, and they say it's kind of interesting because that was...
Wait, and tell me which scholars you talked to, because this is pretty interesting as well, because you talked to some bigwigs.
Yeah, I talked to we did a short movie called Worst Poet Ever, which premiered on the Atlantic, and I don't remember the gentleman's name, but he was actual Victorian scholars about this period in time in Dundonian history. And it's interesting, one of them had the theory that that McGonagall, like, kind of knew he was getting kicked out, he was about to be kicked out of his job, and he needed to come up with some other way to start making money.
Once he turned to poetry in 1877, he very quickly began to assume that he was a lot better than he was.
So is that how he got the poetry bug?
That, you know, you could be thinking about that. Maybe he, you know, his mind is like going, he's like, you know, he's done these plays. He's like, I've got to do something to support my family. What else can I do? You know, write poetry.
Yeah, and again, there's a lot of, like, modern-day context to that, because who do you think would be something like that, where they make that huge leap into, like, I'm suddenly, you know, in show business, you know, without any training? I mean, again, it's like a lot of just empathy for the McGonagall character.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. I can't recall any, some, you know, similar people off the top of my head, but, like, you could imagine kind of the... situation that somebody would be in like that. It's like, well, you know, I'm about to get out of my job. How am I going to support these? I can't remember how many kids they had, like five or six kids. It had a few different kids. A couple of his kids were bad eggs.
Oh, really?
That's what we had. Yeah, because there's a lot of, they have some court records where one of his kids went to jail or was about to go to jail, and McGonagall had to come into court and stuff like that.
Oh, for what?
I think was stealing stuff, and they were just a couple bad eggs, ruffians, you would say. And so McGonagall would have to show up.
Anyway, as McGonagall claimed from the written version of why he became a poet, is McGonagall claimed he was inspired to become a poet when he seemed to feel a strange kind of feeling stealing over him and remained so for about 5 minutes. A flame, as Lord Byron said, seemed to kindle up his entire frame, along with a strong desire to write poetry.
He said he was suddenly touched by the muse. A figure appeared to him, saying to him, write, write, write. And the rest, as they say in the cliche, is history.
Right.
And with that...
Right.
To,
right.
Yeah, right, McGonagall, right. Was that the quote?
Yeah, that's the quote that he says. The spirit was telling him to write, right.
So the spirit was, like, quite literal.
Yes.
The spirit made a declarative sentence of what
was,
he should actually do.
Imperative, an imperative, yeah, statement, right.
Yeah, yeah, there was no metaphor, there was no simile, it was just stating what McGonagall should
the
do.
The world needs you, McGonagall.
Yeah, and so that inspired him to write his very first poem called An Address to Reverend George Gilfillan.
Gilfillan.
All hail to the Reverend George Gilfillan of Dundee. He is the greatest preacher I did ever hear or see. He is a man of genius bright, and in him his congregation does delight, because they find him to be honest and plain, affable in temper, and seldom known to complain.
Gilfillan, which displayed all the hallmarks of a great McGonagall poem that would embed the body of his work, which in his legacy, of course, as being the worst poet in Scottish history.
Yeah, I'm actually, Reverend George Gilfillan was actually a pretty big wig in Dundee in the day. You actually can still see his church that's there in Dundee.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, people knew him about town. People knew who the guy was, and he was, a powerful dude. And McGonagall wrote this poem to him, and he was flattered and kind of became one of his champions, Gilfillan did.
But wasn't Gilfillan also an amateur poet himself? Also
I
considered
he was.
A shitty poet as well?
Yeah, I believe he was. Yeah, I think there are a couple equally shitty poets in Dundee.
Yeah, and Gilfillan's he commented on the poem called An Address to Reverend George Gilfillan. Gilfillan comment admiringly. Yeah, I know it's one of those names that I'll never even
it's
I can say
Scottish.
It a zillion times and never be able to pronounce. He quoted on McGonagall's poem, he quotes, Shakespeare never wrote anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
He preaches in a plain, straightforward way. The people flock to hear him night and day, and hundreds from the doors are often turned away, because he is the greatest preacher of the present day.
Yeah, because one is Shakespeare and one is noted as the worst poet in Scottish history.
so that was it. So just kind of filling a little bit of blanks here is that McGonagall was able to make a little bit of money. This was back in the days when they had like broadsheets and whatnot, and it was kind of along the lines of what you would do is, he'd write a poem, he'd take it to a printer would print it up, and then he'd go around the city selling these copies of the poem, and he'd autograph them or what have you. And they were kind of like, and it was kind of like also like a primitive kind of email newsletter. It was like he would write about he'd write about events that just happened, historical events, weddings and crap like that, and ancient battles and stuff, and then he'd write a poem and then he'd go around town selling them.
Oh, so he's like the guys in Times Square that you see that try to get you to buy their rap DVDs or their rap CDs.
Yeah, exactly.
they're self-produced rap CDs. First, you're selling it on an antiquated form of technology. I don't know. I have a CD player.
Also, to go back to the internet or to go back to the hipster in the park on the typewriter, kind of all the same things.
Yeah, exactly. So, did he write like adverts as well?
Yeah, he actually did a couple of the adverts. I wish I would have pulled one of them up because one of them is actually really, really bad. Like, bad but funny still. It was almost like a parody of a bad ad. It's something about soap that he wrote about. You use this soap and everything will smell better. But the way he phrased it was pretty funny, actually. Yeah, so he did a couple advertisements, as they would say over there, for soap and whatnot and things like that.
And did the soap advert, did it rhyme? Or he was just writing straight copy?
No, it rhymed. It was, that's what I'm saying. It was rhymed, and it had something to do about covering up your smell. I mean, it was actually, borderline okay.
Praise of Sunlight Soap.
Yep, that's it. That's it. Once you read it.
It seems like a poem. In my time, I've tried many kinds of soap, but no other soap can with it cope. Because it makes the clothes look nice and clean that are most beautiful to be seen. All right, let's go one more verse on this. Let's go a deep cut. Ye can use it with great pleasure and ease without wasting any elbow grease. That's good. And while washing the most dirty clothes, the sweat won't be dripping off your nose.
Yeah, there you go. See?
So here's the thing about McGonagall, and we can bring this when we bring the full summary of it, is I think in modern day, we're just so over in the way with just crappy culture and just plain bad, where everything on the internet, you know, gets passed around a zillion times, that this is like tame bad. And I think it was just maybe the whole package of McGonagall, because to me that doesn't seem that horribly bad. But in the time, they considered it, you know, the worst poetry in history. So that ends part one of our podcast on William Topes McGonagall, the worst poet in Scottish history. And next week we'll be back with part two, where we dive into William Topes McGonagall's long-lasting influences on such comedy icons as Monty Python, Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, The Muppets, and of course the Harry Potter series. And with that, it's time to plug away. Scott, do you have anything to plug?
Well, of course, Harmon, there'll be This is the President podcast. You'll be able to hear our latest episodes. Pretty soon, you'll be able to hear us at thisisthepresident.com. But for right now, you can find it over at my website, scottcolonico.com. Also on wordsoverchair.com, where you'll be able to find some of those podcasts as well. So be sure to reach out to us, and, you know, who knows? Get in touch.
And for me, I'll be producing a 4-day storytelling festival in New York City at the People's Improv Theater, The Pit, July 12th through 15th. It's called Storyfest, featuring the best storytelling shows in New York City. And along with that, the whole month of August, I'll be appearing at the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland, doing my new solo show, Harmon Leon's American Horror Story, 9 p.m. at Banshee Labyrinth. So, thanks a lot for tuning in to
Comedy History 101,
where we school you in comedy. And we'll see you next time. Bye bye.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.